Please raise your right hand and repeat after me.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Young.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
As Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were sworn in as President and Vice President of the United States.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Messages of congratulations rolled in from around the globe.
It's a fantastic thing for America. It's a step forward for the country.
Congratulations, President Joe Biden.
Once again, Europe has a friend in the White House.
During his first days in the Oval Office, President Biden sent a clear signal. He rejoined the Paris Climate Accords and the World Health Organization. He stated his intention to rejoin the Iran nuclear agreement. He stopped construction of a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. And he proposed a sweeping immigration bill. The list goes on, and it adds up pretty quickly to a clear repudiation of Donald Trump and the administrative actions he took. So this week, we explore what the new Biden administration's approach to foreign policy will be. Ray Suarez takes it from here.
Thank you. My name is Joe Biden, and I'm Joe.
When Joe Biden was running for president, he warned of dire consequences if the United States didn't rebuild confidence in its global leadership.
Donald Trump's brand of American first has too often led to America alone, making it much harder to mobilize others to address the threats to our common well-being.
Now he's in the Oval Office, and the U.S. is saying to the rest of the world, we're back. But what happened while the U.S. was away?
Well, in foreign affairs, a lot happened. I would say most of it not good.
That's Michael McFaul. He served alongside Joe Biden in the Obama administration, first at the National Security Council, and then as U.S. ambassador to Russia. Now he's at Stanford University, directing the Freeman Spolye Institute for International Studies. Ambassador McFaul, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Ray.
What happened while the U.S. was away?
In broad stroke, I would say, number one, President Trump pulled us away from international engagement and global leadership. He did not believe in multilateral institutions. He didn't really believe in treaties. He had a kind of view of a kind of dog-eat-dog anarchic world out there that we had to compete. And he was America first, as he said, but that meant America alone. And really, you know, in that tradition, we have that tradition in American history. But I think you have to go back to like the 1920s to remember a time that we were so disengaged across, you know, international treaties, multilateral institutions. That's the first thing. The second big thing he did over his 4 years is he stopped talking about democracy and human rights and the rule of law. He basically said that those are not problems that he cared about. And instead, in many places in the world, Russia being one, but Saudi Arabia, North Korea, he engaged with the autocrats. And he had this kind of theory that if he could develop a personal relationship with these autocratic leaders, that would be good for the United States. And again, we have a tradition of that. You know, in academia, we call that realism versus liberalism. The realpolitik approach says, let's just deal with states and don't worry about morality or what happens internally. The liberals, and that's a small L I'm using there. That's not an American L. Sometimes called Wilsonian liberals, sometimes have other labels. They believe that these things matter in American foreign policy and they have consequences. He was radically on the extreme side of that realist side and didn't talk about democracy, human rights. And then third, I would say, you know, I think you should judge leaders by results, not necessarily their aspirations or their words. And I think if you walked around the world and you would say, are we better off or worse off in this issue area or that issue area? You know, I actually graded the president before the election. I think I looked at 15 issues and on 14, he got D's or F's from me, which is to say, are we safer vis-a-vis North Korea today than we were 4 years ago? The answer to that is no, we're not safer. Are we safer vis-a-vis Iran? The answer to that is no, we're not safer. Are our alliances stronger or weaker today than they were 4 years ago? They're weaker today. So, you know, maybe that strategy has worked for other presidents in the past, but I don't think President Trump had many achievements, deliverables is what we used to call them at the State Department, and that's what President Biden inherited today.
The United States has been heavily engaged in the rest of the world since the bombing of Pearl Harbor. I mean, that's a long run.
Yes.
Does that much erode if we either engage in a different way or simply withdraw for just the length of one presidential term? Is there erosion? Is there nothing built up in the bank that makes it easy to just slide back in again?
Ray, I think that's the fundamental question, not just for the next 4 years, but for the next four decades. And I see two scenarios. I know which one I want, but I want to be analytic here. On the one hand, you're absolutely right. It's just 4 years. The very day, you know, literally today, if you look at my email and Twitter feed from people all over the world, I want to tell you, not just from Europe, not just Russia, but all over the world, this is seen as a day where America is back. And they're remembering just 4 years ago that we were engaged that is being celebrated. So one, there's a demand for American leadership that's still there. And two, you know, President Biden, of course, as you mentioned, somebody I know well, I worked with for 5 years, he's going to supply it. There's no doubt about it. He is an engagement guy. He's an internationalist guy. President, I just shouldn't call him guy anymore. He is believes that advancing values is good for the world and good for America. And so for the 4 years, I think there will be progress in kind of getting back to where we were. But two things have happened. One, the world kept moving while we were checked out, China in particular. And two, even among our allies, and I wouldn't want to generalize about this, but you know, I get the sense talking to people I know in European capitals in particular, they're a little worried that Trump is the new long-term trajectory and President Biden is kind of the last hurrah of that era that you're quite right to say started in December 1941.
Now, you mentioned that tension between small L liberals and the realists. I want to take you back to President Trump's inaugural address, where he basically portrayed the deal that the United States made with the transatlantic world and with East Asia as essentially one-sided, that we went out and did all these things for the world, got nothing for it, got nothing in return, and that the world was taking advantage of the United States. If Donald Trump was the only person in America who thought that, it wouldn't have even been in the speech. He became president because he's not alone in that belief. And he became president and carried out that vision. Can Joe Biden, internationalist, NATO fan, multilateralist Joe Biden, come back to the White House as if that interlude didn't happen? Doesn't he have to take some kind of account of what that represented, not only in a one-off President Donald Trump, but what it represented among Americans who believe that?
He can't ignore it. You're absolutely right. But I think it's a multi-pronged strategy for how to address that in the wake of what Trump convinced, as you say, millions, tens of millions of Americans to believe. Number one, he has to take on the facts of what Trump propagated about what you described in that history. It is not true that NATO took advantage of us and we did everything for them and they did nothing for us. That leaves out non-war. And this is very difficult, right? You know, nobody writes a book about a non-war. I teach this here at Stanford. We always focus on events and outcomes and economic disasters and world wars and revolutions. Not a lot of people are writing books about non-revolutions and non-wars, right? But the truth of the matter is that NATO helped us to avoid going to war again in Europe. That is a tremendous achievement. If you remember what happened in World War I and World War II and the very scary things that happened during the Cold War, let's not forget that. Number two, and I would say the same about trade, right? I think Trump, in some ways, rightly focused on some of the abuses and some of the things that did not get enough attention in free trade agreements. I think that that was a useful corrective, but it went too far. The idea that the United States of America and the American people have not benefited from free trade over the last many decades, that is also incorrect. We have benefited tremendously from that. So first, President Biden needs to explain that story. He needs to provide a counter, what I think is more empirically based story of what's happened. And at the same time, notice I didn't say but, at the same time, say that we're not just going back to, you know, the 1990s and kind of trying to reset things, even to at the end of his administration, to acknowledge that we need to change and update and make better for the American people our security arrangements, and to do the same with our trade arrangements. That's a big challenge. That's a big, I want to underscore, that is not easy, but he has to do both. He can't just do one or the other. I think he has to do both of those tasks.
Are you asking him to retell the story of American engagement in the world with a team of a lot of old Obama and Clinton hands who are going to tell the same old story?
Well, yes and no. I'd say, first of all, there's many Clinton hands, but there's a lot of 30 and 40 year olds that are joining this government right now, just so you know, Ray. Two senior directors at the National Security Council are my former students. So that makes me feel old. I do know this team well. I've worked with them. Some of them I've known for decades. I would say that there's an appreciation for what we're talking about. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, this is a subject he's been working on for the last several years, that the connection between domestic policy and foreign policy. He wrote this paper a couple years ago, we need a foreign policy for the American middle class. So I think, and I could go through many, many others, but he's got a very crucial job in this. I think they understand that, number one. Number two, it goes both ways, right? My former Stanford and Oxford colleague and former Obama administration official colleague, Susan Rice, is now heading the domestic policy council because they're trying to blur the lines between international and domestic, saying these things are intertwined. I think that's good. And number three, and this I think we need to watch, but I have, whenever I get a chance, I try to encourage this. In my writings and interactions with these people, they gotta be more engaged in actually communication. There is, you know, I've only lived in Washington a few years of my life. Most of my life, I've lived in Montana, California, and abroad, right? But I go to Washington from time to time and have worked there from time to time. And it is true that there is a bubble in Washington. They all talk to each other. They're all worried about, you know, who's reading their tweet next door. They're not really thinking about, you know, my relatives in Montana in their debates. And I think that they have to really radically change that. They've got to have diplomats that go to Brussels and Berlin and Moscow. But I want diplomats to go to Wyoming and Alabama and California and to explain to the American people, at least engage with them about what they're trying to do in terms of their foreign policy. I think that disconnect of communication, one, allowed President Trump to tell a different narrative, but two, we just can't go back to the old way. We need to be in contact with the American people. Jen Psaki, somebody I worked with in the Obama administration, she's got a brand new job as a few hours ago. I want her to go and talk to those journalists in that tiny little room at the White House. That's part of her job. But I also want her to get on Zoom calls with thousands and tens of thousands of journalists and professors and other people all around America so that they're communicating directly, using, by the way, technology that we've all gotten used to in this horrible pandemic, to make that connection about what they're trying to do, not just with the outside world, but the domestic world, you know, our own country as well.
One place that loomed large over the last 4 years is your region of expertise, Russia and the former Soviet Union. I'm sure there are times in the last 4 years when it drove you up a wall, what you were hearing, but we are where we are. What are the long-term implications of Russia's attempt to divide Americans and to suborn a part of the American governing class to a different way of looking at the world?
Well, it has been tragic to watch. Disinformation is not new to Vladimir Putin. There's a long history of that, both in the Cold War and going back. But technology has enabled these kinds of disinformation operations inside our country. And not just our country, by the way. This is happening all over the world with countries that have the capacity doing this and dividing societies in Africa and in Europe as well. What's been most tragic for me is that oftentimes they were just amplifying. They weren't creating content. They were amplifying content of Americans and in particular, President Trump. And I think we need to acknowledge that they weren't inventing these divides. These divides were being developed and these cleavages occurred. And then our own people were the ones driving them. They were just amplifying and echoing. I also believe that we got to get more serious about these kinds of questions. And of course, there needs to be the free flow of information that, I think, in the long run, benefits the democracies of the world. We cannot start acting like the autocracies. I think we lose that game. But I think we need to be more conscientious and conscious of these actions and take actions to respond. Old fashioned public diplomacy, that I used to do as the U.S. ambassador to Russia. I want us to get out there and do that and to offer our story, not mediated or censored by, in the case that I know the best, the Russian government, but to get out there and do things. And little things, Ray, matter. So, President Trump, right before he was leaving, announced that he was closing our consulates in Ekaterinburg and Vladivostok. That's just shooting us in the foot. I went to both of those consulates. I gave talks and met many people there. In both of those places, there were hundreds, and in the case of Vladivostok, thousands of Russians that wanted to interact with me and come to my talk. Why would we cut that off? I think we have a pretty good story to tell. It's not as good a story as it used to be. And most certainly it needs healing, but we've got to be in the engagement game of not just governments, but people all around the world. And I hope, the Biden team will take that seriously again.
What's often been portrayed as a bright spot, certainly in the last year, is American efforts to bring peace and order to the Middle East. Going forward, I assume the embassy is going to stay in Jerusalem and not get moved back to Tel Aviv. That's done. What's done is done. And I assume that the United States would encourage the at least cessation of cold relations between various Gulf states and Israel. The Trump administration is leaving. Joe Biden and Antony Blinken, where they are, where do you go from there?
Well, I mentioned that report card I gave the Trump administration. The one place where I gave them a B was precisely on what we're talking about. Is it better or not for those Arab states to have diplomatic relations with Israel? Of course it's better. And I applaud that legacy, and that's an important achievement. I would not call that achievement peace in the Middle East, though. Those countries were not at real war with each other. I mean, maybe formally they were, but not in real ways. And let's remember, there are people still dying in the Middle East, in Syria, in Libya, where in Yemen, and the Trump administration did not bring peace to those regions. The Palestinians still live without a state. You don't get to sign an agreement between between actors, one actor, and then leave those actors out. I think that is a giant negative inheritance that the Biden administration now takes on as of today. And, you know, none of those problems in my mind are going to go away easily. And I'm still very troubled by our relationship with Saudi Arabia, by the way. I suspect that will change. Jamal Khashoggi was somebody I knew, the journalist that they assassinated, that regime assassinated. We just can't pretend that we're going to, you know, forget about that. I hope the Biden administration won't just pretend that that didn't happen and just get on with things. And then, of course, you have Iran in the middle of all this. Not only do you not have the nuclear deal, which I thought was made the American people better off, and I hope we get back to that, but Iran also is, you know, using violence and covert operations and propagandistic informational operations throughout the region in a rather aggressive way that the Trump administration did not stop. So that is a pretty tough portfolio for the Biden team to be taken over. I want to say, I know some of these people, and the one thing anyone should know listening to this, you may not agree with all their policies moving forward, and we're going to watch them and roll them out. But I think you should feel good about the fact that very competent, experienced people are coming back to do these jobs. So we're talking about the Middle East. My colleague here at Stanford until yesterday his name's Brett McGurk. Brett worked for the Bush administration, for the Obama administration, and for the Trump administration for a while. He is now the coordinator for Middle East policy at the National Security Council. And I can tell you, having interacted with him for the last 3 years, he is extremely well-versed in the set of issues we're talking about. I feel pretty good that if you're going to have a hard portfolio, it's good to have a guy like Brett McGurk trying to tackle it.
On the eastern frontier of Iran is Afghanistan, where there are still 2,500 troops. The United States has been there since late in 2001, so we'll mark the 20th anniversary of the invasion of Afghanistan in a handful of months. It's astounding. How do you get out, honor the blood we've already spilled there so that something feels accomplished, and also take account of the hundreds of billions of dollars that have been spent there as well?
Another tough issue that the new administration inherits, tragically, as you rightly underscore. And, you know, I don't want to pretend I know what they're planning. I have some inklings, but I don't want to get ahead of my skis. Again, I will say lots of very experienced people are coming back that know this issue well. And, you know, one thing I learned in government when I was there, you know, Ray, we Americans, we tend to be problem solvers, right? We're kind of engineers. There's a problem in the Middle East and we have to solve it. At least that was definitely the kind of can-do attitude that we had in the beginning of the Obama administration, and most certainly was what I came into the government to do. And I learned bitterly over time that sometimes you can't solve problems. You can just manage them. And, you know, sometimes there aren't black and white solutions to very difficult issues. And I fear that Afghanistan is one of those. You know, we should not be fighting a hot conventional war in Afghanistan anymore. I that's my personal view. But that doesn't mean that we should completely withdraw and abandon that place and think that that's not our problem. We actually have some bitter history with that, if you may remember. That's what we did in 1989-90 after the Soviets left, and we decided we didn't need to be engaged in that part of the world. I'm doing this from memory, but I think we went from $2 billion in aid to that region to near zero. And for a long time, we thought, who cared about Afghanistan? That was far away, didn't matter to us. We learned tragically on September 11th, 2001, that it did it should have mattered to us. And so, again, I don't want in any way convey that there's a silver bullet here, it may be tragically one of those places where you recalibrate your engagement and your mission, but you don't completely disengage.
You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. The former U.S. ambassador to Moscow, Michael McFaul, is with me. We're discussing an array of foreign policy and national security challenges facing the new Biden administration. Now let me welcome Jorge Castañeda to the conversation. He's the former Secretary of Foreign Affairs of Mexico, a writer, a professor, the author most recently of America Through Foreign Eyes. Jorge Castañeda, what does America look like from Mexico today?
Ray, it looks, I think, mainly heartening and with a great deal of admiration for the capacity of your country to reinvent itself even after the most difficult moments. I think that would be the first impression that I've gathered. There's been a lot of coverage in Mexico, both in Spanish and in English, a lot of people watching and listening. And I think the first impression is, boy, you guys have this capacity of reinventing yourselves and coming out of the biggest messes you often get yourselves into, by the way. But that's fine, as long as you manage to get out. I think there's a lot of great admiration for that. A second, perhaps, reflection is that the challenges the United States is facing today are very serious challenges, and that go well beyond Trump and January 6th and everything that's happened since the elections. These are deeper, more serious challenges that have to do with inequality, that have to do with systemic racism, that have to do with resolving a series of issues, historical issues. And so the challenges are still there. When you see Vice President Kamala Harris being inaugurated, being sworn in, it obviously moves you. This is, first of all, woman, secondly, black woman, thirdly, immigrant parents, both of them. You know, you can't do much better than that. For the moment, I think everybody's cheering, everybody's happy, perhaps except for our president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He was on the other side. He was cheering for the home team, so to speak, and things didn't come out the way he wanted them to.
Ambassador McFaul, does Mexico get the kind of top drawer attention that either from its size as a trading partner, its influence in Latin America, or the fact that it's right next door, all three of those things that it should get from Washington?
You know, I am not an expert on this bilateral relationship, and most certainly talking to you with the former foreign minister here, I'm not going to weigh in. He knows better than I. I do think there's a couple of things I remember, though, sitting at the White House. I used to sit across the hallway from my colleagues who worked on Mexico, and sometimes there's always competition for the president's time, right? There's nothing more valuable than a phone call or a meeting. And, you know, in the early weeks and months especially, there's a big battle about what President Biden will spend his time on. And I'd like to remind my colleagues, because at that time, Russia was getting a lot of attention. We were negotiating the New START Treaty at the time. And sometimes it's good not to get a lot of attention. Sometimes if you're not getting attention, that means that things are going just fine. And, you know, to echo something we were talking about earlier, Ray, the non-events can sometimes be the very good events in bilateral relations. But I turn it over to the foreign minister to answer your question more precisely.
Ray, I think Mike is absolutely right. There's times when you certainly don't want U.S. attention if you're a country that has, ups and downs in its relationship with the U.S. over now two centuries. And you sometimes prefer not to be sought out or not to be looked at too closely. On the other hand, you do want in Mexico, and I'm pretty sure I know it's the case in Canada, Britain, places like that, that you want to be at the top of the list. As Ambassador said, I remember when I was serving under President Fox in the year 2000, 2001, we were able to convince then President Bush to make his first trip abroad to Mexico. The Brits and the Canadians were not happy about that at all. And then we also were able to convince President Bush to have President Fox have the first state visit to Washington in September before the Brits and before the Canadians for a state visit. And this, you know, is seen very well in your own country because it shows that, you know, the world's only superpower, the world's richest and most powerful country, is paying special attention to you. So you have to balance these two things off. You know, do you want the Americans to look too closely at what's going on in your country and pay too much attention to the outstanding issues? You know, you really don't want that if you can avoid it. On the other hand, yeah, you want the Americans to show that you're special, that they want to be especially gracious, especially welcoming, especially deferent to you.
There are some 30 million Mexican Americans in the United States, people who were born in Mexico and grew up there and came as adults, people whose parents came from Mexico and have never been there themselves, and people whose families were in what is now the United States, but was Mexico 175 years ago. There's varying degrees of attachment, varying degrees of familiarity. Is it a problem or a nice card to have in your hand that this is a very large ethnic community with emotional and cultural ties to your own country when dealing with the United States?
It's a very good question, right? Because it's a little bit of both, quite honestly. I mean, we can only in Mexico be extraordinarily proud, for example, that just yesterday, I guess, Senator Padilla from California was sworn in as the second Californian senator. His parents were born in Mexico. You can't be much prouder of having someone like that be one of the two senators from the largest and richest state in the United States and the world's eighth largest economy. So on the one hand, that's great. On the other hand, when you have a president like Donald Trump, who is constantly ostracizing, insulting, offending your people, quote unquote, in a way, they're our people by heritage, they're American citizens and loyal American citizens by law and by everything else, but there are our people also. And then what do? Do you defend them when Trump offends them? Do you shut up and not get involved and not get into this tit-for-tat business? If you do nothing, you look like you're weak, like you're disloyal to your people. If you pick a fight, you're picking a fight with a strange person, someone who's kind of unpredictable, let's put it diplomatically. So it's complicated, Ray. You never know what to do as a country, and you never know what to do as a government. It's both. I think that what will be very important for Mexico, and this is a big, big, big deal if it goes through, is President Biden's immigration reform. I mean, if he can actually legalize these 11, 12 million undocumented people in the U.S., about half of which are Mexican, somewhere between 50 and 60% are Mexican. The DACAs or Dreamers, about 70% are Mexican. So we don't have any TPSs, but these other cohorts are Mexican. You know, this is enormously important for Mexico from all of these points of view that I'm mentioning. So I really do hope that goes through. It'll be 20 years since we tried to get this done.
I mentioned earlier in the program that on his first day in office, President Biden signed a slew of executive orders reversing many Trump-era policies. One was the halting of the travel ban for Muslim-majority countries. Another was rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement. Dr. Anthony Fauci will lead an American delegation to Geneva to rejoin the World Health Organization. Ambassador McFaul, do we get the privilege of starting over, or does confidence have to be rebuilt, assurance have to be rebuilt that we're not going to just take a powder again the next time it feels uncomfortable or is making us unhappy? Do the other end of the deal in these international agreements, you know, maybe get a little frosted at us and say, no, you know, you don't just get to sashay back in here again.
Well, Ray, your list reminds me that elections have consequences, right? And already today, the decisions that President Biden is making and signing those executive orders are actually affecting Americans' lives today. And so for all those that participated in the electoral process, remember that. I think that's always important. Sometimes it feels like it doesn't matter. It does matter. Number two, you do raise a very important question. I think especially some of our European allies are wondering, you know, do we really want to hand over the leadership of NATO and the free world back to this country that seems unstable? And remember, as you two were both talking about, we face tremendous problems here at home that you cannot just solve with executive orders. These are deep structural issues that will demand a lot of attention from President Biden. And that means he's not going to have as much time to spend on all those things you said in terms of engagement internationally. That all said, I also believe there is demand for American leadership. If you're a small country on the borders of Russia, you want America to be engaged in Europe. You don't want us to be disengaged. If you're a small country on the borders of China, you want to see America engaged, not disengaged. And the last thing I would say, I think we need to remember that Mr. Trump was an aberration, not just for, this is not just a liberal conservative thing, a Republican Democratic thing. He in many ways undermined a lot of traditions in American foreign policy, American engagement in the world. You know, we were just talking about George W. Bush, and I remember very vividly, his interactions with President Fox. And I remember people criticizing him. In fact, Ray, I remember, I'm gonna confess, I remember being at the inauguration for my new boss, President Obama. And as his helicopter took off, we all sang bye, bye, you know, because we thought that he was such a disastrous president. And seeing him today was just so inspirational. It's like, my goodness. And I've gotten to know the president subsequently. What a decent human being. I don't agree with many of his policies. But I think we need to remember that we are returning to, I think, just basic competency. A group of people around the president, including the president, that believes in American leadership, not in this way that Mr. Trump, I hope, I'll add both those verbs, was an aberration to more longstanding traditions.
Well, how about it, Foreign Minister? Let me turn to Jorge Castaneda at that point, because when America wants to let bygones be bygones, wants to come back and say, you know, we made a mistake, now we're engaged again, are they so important that they get to do that when other countries maybe don't? Or is it kind of a pain in the neck to have an unstable, unpredictable America?
No, well, it certainly is a pain in the neck, Ray. I think that's the proper expression. But I also think it's, let's put it this way, the United States is an indispensable pain in the neck. You really can't manage the international system, the international legal, trading, financial, political system without the United States having a somewhat greater leading role, a somewhat lesser leading role, but not disengaging. You really will get no traction on issues, for example, like human rights. I was on the board of Human Rights Watch for 15 years. And, you know, we always got upset, and Ken Roth and people were always upset at the Americans for all sorts of things, and rightly so. But without the United States, you go nowhere. You go nowhere in Latin America. You go nowhere in Hungary or Czech Republic or Russia. Of course, the ambassador knows that much better than I do. You probably go nowhere with or without the United States and China, but at least you want to try. And certainly in countries like Turkey and elsewhere, if you don't have the United States on board to some extent at the Council in Geneva, supporting organizations like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, having the State Department come out with critical annual reviews of the human rights situation in the world, all of these things. If you don't have the U.S. on board, you really aren't you're just going nowhere, because any dictator anywhere will say, what do I care what the French say or don't say? or the Brits or even the Germans. Who cares what these people say? I'm going to do whatever I want. Why? Because the Americans aren't going to bother me. It's a big deal. I mean, that's the way life really is in this business that the ambassador and I have been in for some time. That's real life. And if the Americans aren't there, it's very difficult to get things done in something as specific as human rights, where American, I call it in my book, I call it hypocrisy. If you don't like the term, we can find a better one. But where there has been a great deal of American hypocrisy over decades. Absolutely. There's no question about it. But I'd rather have the hypocrisy than nothing at all.
I want to turn to China for a bit, and you mentioned them obliquely, Foreign Minister, because they are an unpredictable player as well. But one thing that caught my eye was literally just before they walked out the door, the Trump administration pronounced that China was a genocide-sponsoring state and a human rights abuser. And you look at that and you think, all right, well, I guess on its face, that's not a bad thing for an administration that has run hot and cold on whether human rights is important to make that pronouncement. But in the particular case of genocide and crimes against humanity, it actually puts the United States on the hook to make those pronouncements. But when you make them, when you're walking out the door, you're basically setting off a bomb, but you're not waiting around to hear whether it goes off or not. The Chinese were annoyed. The Biden administration has to take some account of this, has to handle it. What do you make of that as statecraft?
I think it's embarrassing in the sense that a country like the United States, a government like the American government, with all of its resources, its tradition, its history, does something like this, which is literally, as you say, stepping out the door, walking out the door, saying something which is undoubtedly true, but which, first of all, for that matter, they could have done 4 years ago. And secondly, which requires a great deal of reflection because, of course, if you're walking out the door, you're not going to pay the consequences for what you're doing. It's the next guys who are going to have to mess with that. But normally, it's going to be the same administration that will have to deal with the backlash from the Chinese, which is probably going to be considerable, and with a series of other implications that a statement of like that does. I'm not sure I'd rather have that than nothing at all. I still think that the United States can do better than that, which is to have a serious reflection on the human rights situation in China for this new administration, and then to, you know, lay down a policy for 4 years of how they want to address this issue, which is a tremendously complicated one. I think it's complicated for China and Russia. A few other countries also, maybe, but nothing like China and Russia. The other ones, I wouldn't say are easy, but they're not as complicated. Those two, I mean, it's a nightmare. I fully appreciate the work that people like Ambassador McFaul and his colleagues do over the years. What in the world do you do with China?
Well, Michael McFaul, dissect that as a gesture, as a piece of policymaking for me. Was it transgressive? Was it just unusual? What was it?
Well, Ray, I think your point is the right one. To do it the day that you're walking out the door is not, you know, that's, you should have done it 4 years ago, and then you should have managed the consequences of that. And I think that's been a big criticism of the Trump team. They seem to care about human rights only in about three or four countries in the world. Everywhere else is okay. And, you know, these are gestures. That's not actually a policy to try to make human rights be better protected inside China. But I do agree with the foreign minister. You know, there is nothing harder than dealing with human rights issues and anti-democratic issues in big, powerful countries. We Americans, we love to lecture small countries, you know, and tell them what to do and use our aid to not when you want to do it. Not all presidents have wanted to do it, but it's very difficult in big places where you have multi, you know, many issues on the table, of which human rights is one of them. I have to say, I'm quite impressed by both then Vice President, now President Biden's approach to that. I've traveled to Russia with him, as well as places like Ukraine and Georgia and Moldova. And I think he gets it. I think he believes that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, that we have security interests, economic interests, and we can talk about those without checking our values at the door. I think conceptually, he's right about that. Making it work in reality is very, very difficult. And I agree. China and Russia are the two hardest places in the world to walk and chew gum at the same time.
One big challenge that remains for the United States and for the rest of the world is the COVID-19 pandemic. The United States has made clear that it wants to remain engaged with the rest of the world, and I think the WHO rejoin is meant to signal that. There's also a little bit of vaccine nationalism that gets mixed in there. There is the fact that this is not a static world. People move around, and people need to move around, in addition to want to move around. Does COVID-19, Jorge Castañeda, present an opportunity as well as a threat to re-engage, to get back on the soft power track in American diplomacy?
Well, I think it presents a great opportunity, Ray, but also there's a little bit of a pitfall there. In other words, I think it's extraordinarily important, of course, that the U.S. rejoin the WHO and that Dr. Fauci attend virtually or in presence, the annual assembly in Geneva. But what people are going to be looking for all over the world, particularly in the poorer countries, is whether the United States, which has once again showed its prowess in science and technology, is willing to make some sacrifices in order to have poor countries have access to vaccines, perhaps somewhat in detriment to some groups in the United States for a few days, a few weeks, maybe even a couple of months. Because as you know, we all know there's not enough vaccines to go around. Now, if you want to be nationalistic about it, like Trump was, you say everything that Pfizer produces in the U.S., in Michigan, goes to Americans. And only what they can ship out of Belgium goes to anybody else. And by the way, what goes to anybody else is what anybody else can pay for. And we don't care if, you know, people in Mali or wherever get any vaccines. Well, obviously, President Biden won't do that, but not doing that is not good enough. He actually has, I think, to do something in terms of getting American-made vaccines, getting them to the poorer countries, which are not able, really, to get in the line on their own. That's a fact.
Ambassador McFaul, that's the kind of real-world question that in real life bedevils people at the State Department and in other policymaking venues. You're kicking this around the table. There's positive and negative cases to be made. There's real life domestic politics with more people wanting the vaccine than can get it, who may not be particularly altruistic or happy if a Mauritanian gets the vaccine and they don't. But there's real reasons why it's a good idea for a Moroccan to get the vaccine or a South African to get the vaccine. How do you balance all those exquisitely difficult challenges of need, of ethics, of what the right medical answer is versus what the right political answer is? What are the kinds of things that come up around the table when you're hashing these kinds of things out?
Well, this goes back to our earlier conversation about the blurring of the domestic and the international, right? This is exactly an issue where those things feel like trade-offs and zero sum. And that is the way, unfortunately, the Mr. Trump has framed him for the last 4 years. So for millions of Americans, they're already thinking in this black and white term. If it's good for them over there, that means it's bad for us in this zero sum. And I think, one, you have to make the hard policy decisions first, right? And Jorge, now I'm going to call him Jorge because we've been talking for an hour instead of foreign minister. But I really,
please, Michael,
it's lovely to talk with you. It's really an honor. Those are real trade-offs that they're going to sit in the White House Situation Room and make those judgments, trying to square the circle of what's good for us. And it's not black and white, right? It can't be vaccinate all Americans and then do nothing for other people around the world. They should make those decisions. I think you then do two other things. One is you use American diplomacy to work with other countries to get more of our folks to help in this common cause. I think the vaccine wars, wars is not the right word, but you know, this is an area where China is doing well in the world. And we tend to think that we're ahead and all that. Well, there are a lot of people who are going to get a Chinese vaccine before they get an American or a European. And they're going to remember that, by the way. And there's a lot of countries that would prefer to get American and may have to take a Chinese, or in the case of, say, Ukraine, a Russian, because we're not doing these things. So one, you have to make that decision, and they're hard decisions. There's not a silver bullet. But then you need to explain that decision to the American people. The American people have to know why it's both good and it's in our self-interest for the people of Mali also to be vaccinated. That the world fundamentally is not zero sum, that if you look for win-win opportunities, that can make the people of Mali and the people of America in the long term better off. Whether you're talking about vaccines or trade or security, that framework, I think, needs to be adopted by the Biden team, but then they have to explain it. They just cannot assume that the American people are just going to understand that. And that communication piece, I would say self-critically, we in the last years of the Obama administration didn't do that very well. You know, you may remember there was this thing called the Trans-Pacific Partnership that we were leading on. And, you know, I think it was a really good deal for the American people. But we didn't explain that to the American people. And that was a big mistake. And I think that communication piece has to be a much bigger part of foreign and domestic policy for the Biden team moving forward.
American presidents, when it comes to policies like that, have to be evangelists. They have to explain why they're doing what they're doing, not just what they're doing. Foreign Minister, as we look out ahead, give me a hopeful but realistic assessment of the Mexican-American bilateral relationship in the coming years. What do you think, if things go okay, not spectacularly, but well, this is where we are in 4 years?
Well, we will have had to deal with several issues that, in a sense, have been pending for many years. The first ones perhaps stem from the USMCA, or New Trade Agreement, which has much stronger labor and environmental provisions than NAFTA had, and I think that's for the better. But again, this all has to be enforced. It has to take place. You know, there's nothing people in Mexico would like better than for Mexican wages to rise, or for Mexican unions to be democratic and powerful, and for collective bargaining and other labor rights to be respected, let alone the environment. But that has to happen, and it has to happen with a certain amount of dexterity and fine-tuning, because if the United States begins to, you know, bully Mexico into doing these things, there will be a prickly Mexican reaction. If the United States does nothing, then none of this will happen. It certainly won't happen because we in Mexico are going to do it out of our own willingness. I know my country well. I love it, but you know, I know where I'm from. It's not going to happen. So that's one. The drug issue is another one. I mean, I hope that President Biden goes forward with the then candidate Harris's commitment to legalizing recreational marijuana at a federal level. I hope that happens. But you know, what will it look like for the United States to ask Mexico to find tunnels dug across the border, under the border, to smuggle marijuana into California when it's legalized at a federal level and not just at a California level? It's ridiculous. So, you know, you have to update many of these things. The immigration question will be fundamental. Obviously, reform is more important than anything else. But there are 70,000 Central Americans, Cubans, whatever, on the Mexican side of the border, living in terrible conditions now for over a year, waiting for a hearing that they were never going to get for asylum. Now, the United States can process those requests any way it wants, but those people should be processed in the U.S., not in Mexico. You know, with all due respect to them and to the United States, they are not ours. We should treat them far better than we do, obviously. We mistreat them terribly. But at the end of the day, they want asylum in the U.S. They don't want it in Mexico. I wouldn't want it in Mexico either in their condition, because they can get beat up, kidnapped, hit, whatever, by the drug cartels, by the people smugglers, by all of this. I mean, you want asylum in the U.S. That's where you chose to ask for it. So I think these are all issues which have been pending. There are many more, but I just mentioned these three. We have to address them. And I think it will be very important to see how the Biden team does this. I hope that very soon there's a very high-level meeting between the two administrations, whether it's in Washington, in Mexico City, at the border, wherever. It doesn't make any difference. But I hope that takes place very quickly, Ray.
And a final comment from Ambassador McFaul. Given realism, given where things sit today, what would be a good outcome in the near and midterm for the U.S.-Russia bilateral?
With respect to Russia, you know, one of my colleagues in Moscow, who we do things from time to time together with, who has a little more pessimistic view of the world than I, he always ends and answers to questions like you, Ray. He always answers, let's just avoid war. So remember, you know, basic things like that are the first act of diplomacy. Number two, you should never have a conflict based on misperceptions or misunderstandings. We're going to have a lot of conflicts between the United States and Russia moving forward, but we haven't had much diplomatic engagement at very high levels for a long time there, and I worry about that happening. So number two, let's just make sure that doesn't happen. Third, sign the new START treaty and extend it for 5 years. That's good for Russia, that's good for the United States, and that's good for the rest of the world. We want to be decreasing the number of nuclear weapons in the world, not opening that up. And then fourth, I want to see more societal engagement. This is something that the Trump team was not very good at either, in my view, partly because of their visa and immigration policies. But I think it's in America's national interest to have lots of Russians come to America, lots of Chinese, lots of Mexicans. I want people to come to our country. I think that's one of our biggest strengths in terms of our soft power. And I, you know, with respect to the bilateral relationship, that will do more than any other thing to decrease the misconceptions that many Russians have about Americans today. And by the way, to help the misconceptions that a lot of Americans have about Russians today. Putin is not Russia. He is the leader of Russia. He's an autocratic Russian leader. There are many Russians who disagree with him, including some incredibly brave ones like Alexei Navalny, who's risking his life for a more democratic society. We need to be exposed to a more complex Russia as well. So it's a two-way street. A little more societal engagement, I think, between the United States and Russia would do both of our countries good.
Michael McFaul was America's ambassador to Russia in the Obama administration. He's the author most recently of From Cold War to Hot Peace, An American Ambassador in Putin's Russia. Great to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me.
And Jorge Castañeda is the former Secretary of Foreign Affairs of Mexico, a writer, a professor. He teaches at my alma mater, New York University, and he's the author most recently of America Through Foreign Eyes. Foreign Minister, always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Ray.
You've been listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. An editor's note. Since we recorded Ray's conversation with Michael McFaul and Jorge Castañeda, the Biden administration announced its intention to renew the landmark nuclear arms control agreement with Russia, known as the New START Treaty. Our program is produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, First Republic Bank, and Chevron. This episode was produced by Joanne Jennings and Jared Sport. Ray Suarez co-hosted. Temba Daniels provided research support. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.